first right now, what they want is that we should not be towards religion, because they know it is religion that's taking you towards science.
Yes.
And it's science that is taking you back towards religion. Mm-hmm. I think they are so correlated. They so much coexist, as Brother rightly mentioned. See, when we study religion, what is the first stage? Belief.
Yes.
What is the first stage that a person should have? Belief. See, the world has shown us that religion is something that you have to only follow, wherein you have to do taqleed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have another part of religion that is, like, we have an important part of religion that is belief, wherein you use reasoning, wherein you use thinking, you use logic. And when we study this
belief... So what does this belief
I'll tell you. When we study this belief one by one, the first part is monotheism. Tawheed.
Yes.
And when we are going deep into it, what does it say? Look into the nature. Look around you.
And this looking into science. Go for science.
Exactly. Look at the structure of your body. Look at the nature. And when you're studying, looking, you know, understanding nature, that is science. And where it is taking you? It is, science is showing you order in everything. It is showing you that balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it is again telling you that this is beyond human beings. This is beyond the mind of human being. This organization, this system, this structure, had there been so many gods, the world would have not been like that.
Mm-hmm.
It again takes you back to Tawheed.
But you know, imagine I'm a listener, a young listener. Perhaps I don't have so much of knowledge about what's going on beyond the curtains. Mm-hmm. And I would say, okay, in looking Western society, I see they do not focus so much on religion, but they have so much of development. So it is true to say that science alone can improve you, can make developments, and there is no need for religion. What's your point, brother?
We see progress. We see development in a physical manner.
Yes, that's the question many people ask.
So
there is no need for religion.
So why this did, or the moving away from religion, again, there's a historical background to it, and there's a particular reason. To mention it may be a bit difficult for me to explain it in the short period mm-hmm. of time. But basically, there's a classification of the different sciences and knowledge that you have.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theoretical side of it. In those theoretical side of it, you have three levels. Science, obviously, is one of those levels, but the lowest of the levels.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning what? That science does show you a part of reality. Suppose you're something that is real,
mm-hmm.
right? There's no doubt about it. But it is the lowest part of reality. Physical world, physical matter.
Based on what you're saying this?
This is based on a classification of knowledge that was propounded by Aristotle. Aristotle has a classification of knowledge.
Yes.
Where he breaks it into two sides, the theoretical side and the practical side. On the theoretical side, you have three levels.
Yes.
The highest being metaphysics.
Yes, the highest is metaphysics.
The second being mathematics, the third being physics. And then he goes into the practical. The practical starts with ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Then domestics, which is the household, and then civics, which is politics.
Yes.
So obviously, why is the classification like this? Is that when a person is well aware of the theoretical side of knowledge of the world around him,
mm-hmm.
first of all, understanding that theoretical side, what are you doing? You are not creating anything.
Mm-hmm.
You are discovering. It is already in front of you. All you are doing is uncovering things that were there in front of you. And as you say, you're just kind of removing the curtain that was already there. Or you're opening your eyes wider.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't create anything. You didn't make anything.
Mm-hmm.
You have just uncovered it. You have just found it. When all that is done to a certain level, the highest obviously being then the study of the absolute cause, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Again, just to mention this, before the Renaissance, what was the highest science studied in universities throughout Europe?
Mm-hmm.
It was theology.
Yes, theology.
Theology was the highest science studied in all universities
because
throughout the world.
Because the church was the so church, powerful.
Not even the church, just a person who would study in
yes,
Italy,
yes.
in Milan, in Paris, in England. They would study theology. And only a select group of people would be able to study it. They will not let anybody study it. That would then lead into the ethics and then, but that's a different discussion altogether. So science, a person, a youngster, always not knowing this, will look at the world and say, oh, but look at the progress that the world is making. But then the question would be, okay, that progress, that science that he's making, is he making you a better human?
Science alone?
So you would ask that youngster, yes, is he making you a better person? Technology, which is obviously the fruit of science, which is all technology, ease of life, takes one away from family, takes one away from loved ones, takes one away from reality,
mm-hmm.
takes one further away from themselves.
But when it comes with religion, it's in a different level.
Because then when you discuss it, as I mentioned, it's a person will understand that science is the lowest part of reality. It is a part that shows me there is something greater.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get to that which is greater somehow. And that by is becoming what is known as tazkiyatu nafs, or the purification of the soul,
mm-hmm.
which obviously is with this what the religion tells you about, be a good person, but not for the sake of being a good person. The intention is important. Everything that you do has an effect on it. Why are you doing it? Who are you doing it for?
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Zainab, you think that science alone is not going us a happy person. We need to have religion coexisting with that in order to make us a perfect person.
I personally do not consider science and religion to be two different things. I think religion is a science. Science is an interdisciplinary phenomenon. Like, it is not in one field. There is some university of some time, we had theology as one of the greatest sciences. What is theology? Theology is religion. I think religion is science itself. Religion is not something that's apart from science. What our dear prophet, may peace be upon him, said, he said, "Anna madinatul ilmun wa aliyun babuha." I am the city of knowledge, and Ali is its
the gate. Entry.
Is the gate, is the entry to that ilm, to that knowledge. And what is the one of the alqabs, what is one of the, you know, names that our fifth Imam, Imam Baqir al-Islam, is known by? Baqirul Ulum.
Yes.
He is known by this name. Whenever some question was asked to him, he used sprout like so much knowledge out of it. He used to give a fountain of so many ideas, so many things.
Yes,
he used
information.
A fountain of information on a particular topic. Imam Baqir al-Islam once had some debates with some Christian scholars. A Christian scholar comes and says, the best Christian scholars of that time, the best researchers, they come to him, and some non-religious people come to him who are very, very great in science.
Our imams, God's blessings be upon them all, they have always been giving people hints about knowledge and science. They have always been like
just
this.
Look at
that means our religion is the religion of logics and science. We talked about religion and science as one single thing, not two different things. In our religion, we consider science as a part of our religion. There is no way to separate these two important things. Again, thanks for being with us. Until next time with Back to Reality, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you with health and happiness.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again. Once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2%, with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the Bold Escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The third edition of the annual conference on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, dubbed General Soleimani and New Islamic Civilization. The conference was held online this time, with 50 scholars and political pundits from across the world giving speeches.
General Qasem Soleimani is a martyr, and he died fighting the head choppers and the throat slitters, and a brave, a charismatic leader. And we all honor his life.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism and the guarantor of regional stability. Should Iran and Russia have sat on their hands and not defeated the terrorists in Syria and Iraq, they would have had to fight them in their own soils.
We know that the U.S. and some other countries use terrorism under the banner of religion to topple the Syrian government and move the battlefield to Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and the entire region. But Soleimani shattered all the U.S.'s calculations.
Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations.
The security of the Zionist regime is an important issue for all of the American governments. What General Soleimani did was to put Palestine in top of the Muslim world's priorities. And then he gathered and united all of the groups that opposed Israeli occupation as the resistance axis. This was the major motive for the U.S. to assassinate him.
Iran and Iraq have set up joint investigation committee on General Soleimani's assassination. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
Iranian and Iraqi judicial teams are seriously following up on a legal pursuit to bring the culprits to justice. Iraq is where the assassination took place and has so far kept close cooperation with Iran. In the four-day conference, we're also going to discuss legal dimensions of Soleimani's assassination.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists. General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. The United States killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that puts Washington on the terrorists' team. This as Iran is firmly following up on its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again.
against Iranian military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here, too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. A Storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in three decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. Three people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s, traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when this tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her, but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species. Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Friday, school pupils held protests in over 40 cities across Italy demanding the government to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school. The demonstrations were staged after a student, 16-year-old Giuseppe Lenoci, died in a road accident on Monday while he was on board a truck for a school work internship. Last month, another student, 18-year-old Lorenzo Perrelli, was crushed to death by a steel girder of 150 kilos while working in an internship for a private company.
È una vergogna.
They should be ashamed. School principals should be reported to the authorities for striking deals with private companies without being provided assurances on working conditions in factories. They have been reckless and should be punished.
Lavoro non pagato, praticamente sfruttamento.
Schoolwork internship is equivalent to unpaid work. It is just another form of exploitation. In most cases, it doesn't give anything to students. It only helps companies make more profit.
About 3,000 students gathered in central Rome demanding the government to remove the education minister and scrap obligatory work experience programs for high school students introduced by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in 2015. In Turin, tension and anger went out of control when a group of students tried to break into the local headquarters of industrial employers group Confindustria and were repelled by police with some batons being wielded, with at least 7 officers being hurt.
We are staging protests also to raise awareness over our living conditions as young adults. Our generation is suffering greatly also from the anti-COVID measures, which restricts our freedom to move, to interact socially. We are left alone with our phones following school lessons online, with our psychological scars, and the government is not doing anything to help us.
School dropout levels in Italy are among the highest in the EU, and due to the pandemic, with the government quickly deciding to make all learning remote. Also, the cases of social withdrawal and self-harm among young people are on the rise, healthcare professionals are warning. In the past 2 years, and especially in recent months, Italy has been the scene of protests across the country. Rallies have been held against deteriorating living conditions, mandatory vaccination and health passes, as well as what the protesters describe as the government's mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the ultimate goal of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies?
The protesters said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the US and Israel, is the commonality of structural racism, says Binay Blend's political commentator in an article titled Evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. If housing is a human right, whose rights really matter? Stay tuned for more. In 1948, the United States signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UDHR, acknowledging satisfactory housing as part of the human right to an adequate standard of living. Nevertheless, soon after the recent end of the moratorium, evictions slowly began to rise. What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the U.S. and Israel, is the commonality of a structural racism. Indeed, the latest uprising in Palestine stemmed from efforts to evict residents of Sheikh Jarrah in order to replace them with Israeli settlers. It is this structural racism on the part of the Zionist regime that lends the liberation struggle to its international anti-colonial cast. Observers Onye Snow Chatoyer, an organizer with the African People's Revolutionary Party and the All African Women's Revolutionary Union, an editor with Hood Communist, also serving on the National Committee of the Ven Saramos Brigade, said, "From the very first days of its birth, born from a wave of African and indigenous blood, the United States has built its empire on the backs of the masses of poor and colonized people inside and outside of its borders. According to the Eviction Lab, nearly one in four black renters lives in a country in which the black eviction rate is more than double the white eviction rate. Moreover, formal eviction proceedings are only a part of the problem. As Sophie Kasowich notes, many tenants are illegally locked out or their utilities are shut off, thus forcing them to leave their homes." A case in point drawn from a forthcoming press release and Facebook post on February 5th, 2022, Asaneta Nekormotore, a long-term community organizer in Philadelphia, an anti-Zionist friend of Palestine, received a 30-day notice to vacate the home that she had been renting for several years. A short time later, some of the new owner's family members started moving in a while. She's still in the house, using a fraudulent lease with different language than the one she signed. The new owner declared that Nekormotore is now a month-to-month housemate, confined to the bedroom rather than the entire house. Nekormotore said, "We need a stronger good cause legislation in Philadelphia. Without it, landlords can sell their property, make a tremendous profit, and push renters out using a move-in eviction, where the new tenant moves in while the current tenant is still there, using implied threats and other forms of intimidation to force the current tenant out. This is very dangerous and has a great potential for violence." In the United States, tenants like Nekormotore have access to the legal system, albeit that it often does not work in their favor. In Sheikh Jarrah, where Ramzi Barut reports that Israel uses the law to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, there is no such recourse to the courts. As Barut points out, this most recent ethnic cleansing has a long history, justified through a series of laws unique to Israel, laws that give a legal cover to outright theft and land robbery. Indeed, after a month-long physical and legal battle to avoid eviction, four Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah received the Zionist regime's court's decision that could stay in their homes for 15 years as protected residents. As such, they were required to pay the new Jewish owners a biennial sum of 2,400 shekels. Amounting to $743. There are major differences between illegal evictions in Al-Quds neighborhoods as a cover for ethnic cleansing and rising evictions in the states. Nevertheless, what unites them is communal resistance to what Chaytor describes as settler colonial violence. From Gaza to Al-Quds and the West Bank, Palestinians participated in what came to be known as the Unity Intifada. This unity eclipses Fatah and Hamas and all the rest, wrote Barood, adding, because without a united people, there can be no meaningful resistance, no vision for liberation, no struggle for justice to be won. Moreover, Barood contends that the uprising that was instigated by the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah was but a microcosm of a larger issue. The ongoing atrocities in Palestine date back to 1948 and continue to this day, but so does the resistance. In Philadelphia, friends responded to Nekor Matoura's call on social media for support in the face of eviction by intimidation. On February 7th, she wrote, if you want to witness a possible illegal move in eviction, come to my house tomorrow, Monday, February 7th. A group of supporters has been present since Monday, February 7th, and will continue to support her as she faces move-out intimidation. As in Palestine, the response was communal. Members of the Poor People's Army and Friends, who represented various activist organizations, arrived to ensure Nekor Matoura's safety. Another commonality is that she represents only one case study of infringement on housing rights of people all over the country, a crisis that looms larger as landlords seek to obtain high rents in a booming housing and rental market. In Palestine, the motive behind evictions is ethnic cleansing. In the U.S., it is disregard for what are considered disposable people whose rights matter less in a capitalist economy than those who reap high profits. What unites them is global resistance movements to settler colonial regimes. This kind of solidarity is crucial to Palestine's liberation. While Palestinians have proved that they are quite capable of saving themselves, collaboration with the Global South, which includes Black Americans, is an important step in the liberation struggle towards freedom.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. So, I don't know which part of the world you guys are in. So on the previous episode of Muslim Lady, for those who've just joined us or those who've been with us through this journey, we were talking about the expectations of society, the expectations society has of Muslim women. When we talk about society in general, the issue of double standards inevitably is raised. And that whether or not society is fair and just towards regarding its expectations from men and women. And I think that's evident in all societies, whether Muslim or not.
But something that is good these days is that people are becoming less hypocrite.
Definitely.
We had two problems. Double standards, maybe two decades ago, one decade ago. People had these two double standards. They didn't know what to do. Like they grabbed some part from this standard, some part from this standard, as some people call it, or camel, cow, and tiger. Okay. That, you know, they say that these days our personalities and our identities are a combination of so many different things that have come together, right? So you can imagine an animal that has the head of a cow, that has wings of a bird, that has like the body of a horse and the legs of a ostrich, something like that. And I was actually thinking about it. I think it's true. Like, you know, us women, 50 years ago, you either stayed at home and you wore a complete hijab when you went out and you had your man as everything, your source of support economically, or it was the case that you believed in no hijab, you were Western, you had...
Which society are we talking about here?
I'm talking, for example, about the society of Iran.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Or you didn't believe in any hijab, or even I'm talking about Egypt. I'm talking about Syria. I'm talking about Lebanon, right? Back then, we had Islamic values, traditional Islamic values, and you had modern reformist ideas where you believed, yeah, well, you know, there's no place in the Quran talks about hijab. Actually, hijab is a patriarchal thing to limit women, and that if you segregate men and women from each other in the society, women will greatly be damaged because they will not have any experience of how to react with the men, and they're not going to be successful life. So there should be integration of men and women, no hijab, women going to university, studying everything.
I'm so confused as to how can someone interpret hijab as a patriarchy thing.
Nowadays, if I tell you why women wear hijab, you say, because I'm a human being. I want a man to see my inner human beauties rather than my outer
curves, you know, and charms.
Exactly.
And this is all what I've always understood from hijab.
Exactly. This is what we have been learning in the past decade. This is how we grew up.
Yeah.
But 30, 40 years ago, when the concept of hijab was raised, women would not say that. Women were not that educated. Women did not really... A lot of men, even until 60, 70 years ago, believed that the human status of men and women is not the same, is not equal. Mm-hmm. Now we take it for granted that the value in human status, that women are as human as a man, that women are as valuable as a man. Can you believe that less than a century ago, some men used to think that women are not in the same value status or human status as women. Now you take it for granted. And back then, even I'm talking about 50 years ago, that hijab was like, this woman, I am the man of this woman, and this woman has to stay in the house, and she's my property. She's my woman. She's my weak. I own everything about her.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I didn't grow up in a non-Islamic country, right? And
you didn't grow in a non-Islamic country?
No, I grew up in a non-Islamic country, okay. Right? And maybe 50-60% of my ethnic background is not Middle Eastern, not Muslim. And so when you say these things, that there was a time, or maybe still is in certain societies, that the woman was considered as a man's property, I cannot place it in any culture that I associated myself with, right? Islam came to say that, look, you see this woman? She's an individual creature of creation of God on her own. She's valued, she's loved, she's respected, she's got rights. She's your equal in life and death. You're maybe a little stronger than her, but your souls are the same, and that's what God judges you on. Stop acting like you own her. Here is Islam to liberate women and give them back their God-given rights and empower them.
All these are thoughts that we have been learning after the Islamic Revolution.
And then 1400 years later, the exact opposite is happening exactly. In the name of Islam. And exactly. I'm like, ugh, the irony.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
This is exactly true. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, and I'm not just talking about an Iranian thing. You know, in all these Muslim countries, unfortunately, people were divided into different groups. But considering the bigger picture, you were either traditional Muslim,
mm-hmm.
which where you believe that you only have to stick to the wordings of the Quran and the Riwayat, the mm-hmm. narrations, or you were a reformist, right? That where you believe that, you know, so many things have to change and so many incorrect, false information was added to the interpretation of the Quran and the Riwayat by yeah. people who brought in their background knowledge to understand and to analyze the meaning of the Quran and the Riwayat, mm-hmm. right? So you have people like Nasser Abu Zayd, you know, who was a reformist, or you have people like Muhammad Abduh, or you have people like Fatima Mernissi. A lot of these people are in Egypt, mm-hmm. these reformists who think that the Quran came to bring a revolution to the lives of men and women. Mm. And the prophet started a revolution, but because he passed away and, you know, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, people deviated his path. We believe that, yes, the Prophet came and Saqifah happened. But then after the Prophet, أَيْنَ السَّبَبُ الْمُتَّسَلُ بَيْنَ الْأَرْضِ وَالسَّمَاءِ, we have the Imams. Where is the chain that connects the heaven with the earth?
Yeah, all of this could have been avoided.
Yeah, but anyhow, let's look at the reality.
Yeah, we're not it is what it is.
Utopia, right? So in reality, we do have the link to the heavens, to the sky, mm-hmm. to the revelation, to Wahy, which are the Imams of our time,
yeah.
of each time. When Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farjahu sharif, he reappears, the religion has been changed so much, and there's so much understanding, different understanding of religion, that when he comes and he brings the real Islam,
you're like, oh my God, it's a new religion.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
What have you been following all these years?
Exactly. The Prophet says in a hadith that, I am so proud of my followers that they, you know,
during the ends of time.
Exactly, yeah. that they haven't seen me, but they believe in me and they follow in my footsteps. So they're
at least they try, you know.
At least they try.
Even though the footsteps of Rasulullah and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have been blurred much through exactly. the years. We try to
follow them. But then this again here, the double standards, you know. I'm just saying that what goes on in history, everything that is happening throughout the years, we are human beings and we're living, we're mortal creatures, right? Mm. We are influenced by our surroundings. We are influenced by, you know, the doctrines that is going on around us.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
After the Islamic Revolution, you know, the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, like Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayhi, and Ayatollah Khamenei, they have tried to stick to the teachings of Shiism, and they've really tried to bring up what the teachings of Islam is with regards to women.
Exactly. And, right. you know, they talk about that so much, I wouldn't be surprised if certain backwards, close-minded Muslim individuals would label these people as feminists.
Exactly.
Or Islamic feminism.
Exactly.
What they're doing is just Islamic. You know, you really don't need to put any label on them.
Exactly.
But what they say has been so neglected and it's turned so rare that you feel like, oh, they're just making this stuff up, you know? And it's sometimes sadly, unfortunately, tragically, so very much in contradiction with what many Muslim societies believe regarding women, as far as Islam is concerned, that, you know, it seems far-fetched. And they feel like he's trying to use women as a tool, as a political tool. But the man was just saying, look, maybe pick up a book or two and know that, yeah, this is what your religion is saying about you. Stop being the victim and allowing other people to victimize you.
Exactly. Going to the words of Ayatollah Khamenei,
mm-hmm.
because some researchers have collected his words on women and family, and it has been compiled into 6-7 volumes of books,
mm-hmm.
right? So I was just going through his beliefs, the words of Ayatollah Khamenei regarding women. From what he was saying and also from my own analytics, I tried to come up with what, you know, as a Muslim woman, what do I think the society, the Muslim society, or, you know, the Muslim crowd expect from a Muslim woman? And the first thing that came to my mind was, what do you think? This is something that is shared between men and women. Because you remember in the very beginning you said, it's really interesting to talk about this topic, but then if you're expecting so much from a woman and then you're just excluding the man from this expectation, it's really not unfair. It's really unfair.
So this is a common expectation.
Exactly.
I don't know, be a good Muslim.
Be a good Muslim. How? This is something that you could see in Sardar Soleimani. Evident, vivid quality you saw in him. Sincerity. I didn't know Sardar Soleimani much. But when I heard the news of his martyrdom, my whole heart ached.
Exactly. It was and like losing a father.
Everyone, religious and non-religious, government, pro-government and anti-government, they all wept for him.
The branch we've reached at this point has been that the society and women and men alike have deviated a lot from how a Muslim woman should be. And we've lost our sense of identity along the way. And along came the Islamic Revolution and redefined these lines and these roles for women and for the society to understand and accept a lot. But then again, it's a work in progress and it's not easy. And more on that on future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio.